because genocide against native people is still going on today all over the world.
Native Solidarity in News. It's about you, too. CKUT, CKDU, CFBEX, CFUV, CHFN, CHLY, CHMA, CHSR, CJLY, CJSF, CJSW, Radio 90.
Of all independence.
Welcome once again to Native Solidarity News, a national radio service and part of an international network of information and action in support of Indigenous people's survival and dignity. We are all volunteers committed to promoting Native self-determination, culturally, economically, spiritually, and otherwise. Produced at CKUT Community Radio since 1996, NSN is now also broadcast on over 20 stations across occupied Canada. We try to make each 60-minute program as welcoming and challenging to someone who has never heard of the issues as it is to a weekly listener. Each week you tune in for news and an in-depth feature, and this week we will hear from Indigenous nations that are bifurcated, split in two, by the U.S.-Mexico border, from a conference that happened in California called Encuentro. I'm joined here by Urkar and JJ. JJ is going to investigate some sound. How are you doing, Urkar?
Oh, I'm doing good. I'm doing really good. So how are you doing, JJ?
I'm doing pretty good, thanks.
Righto. So we're going to play a quick song, and then we'll be right back.
Indian legislation's on the desk of a do-right congressman. Now, he don't know much about the issue, so he picks up the phone, and he asks advice of the senator out in Indian country. A darling of the energy companies who are ripping off what's left of the reservations. I learned a safety rule. I don't know who to thank. Don't stand between the reservation and the corporate bank. They'll send in federal tanks. It isn't nice, but it's reality. Bury my heart. Cover me with
welcome back to Native Solidarity News. We've just been listening to Buffy St. Marie on her song "Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee."
All right, we've got some news items here today. In Ohio's vantage point, the best for lunar rising. 2,000 years ago, a group of American Indians built the vast lunar observatory that to this day accurately predicts where the moon will rise. And this weekend, hundreds and possibly thousands of people will descend upon Newark, Ohio, to see those predictions come true. They will stand at one end of what's known as the Octagon Earthworks, a lunar observatory built on the Earth itself. They will look across a 20-acre circle and beyond, connecting a 50-acre octagon to a spot where the moon is expected to rise at its northernmost point in the eastern horizon. This happens once every 18.6 years, while the exact date for the northernmost rising will be September 14, 2006. The event is being celebrated this year on October 22nd. It will be a major day, attracting astronomers, archaeologists, American Indians, students, and others to be to the site 40 miles east of Columbus. The Newark earthworks were constructed by the people of the so-called Hopewell culture, which was the human presence in the area of 200 BC to 500 AD. The culture was first identified as at an archaeological site on the farm of a man named Hopewell, thus the academic name. The archaeological records suggest that the members were concentrated along the lower Ohio River drainage area. The Hopewell people were a non-literate prehistoric culture which faded out many centuries ago, so there is no record of what they may have called themselves. They are often referred to as mound builders for their habit of not only interring the dead in funerary mounds of various sizes, but also constructing vast and mysterious geometric earthworks whose purpose is unclear. Still, the Octagon Earthworks hasn't captured people's attention like the Mayan, Aztec, or Incan temples, whose structures were built more than to align with the sun than the moon. The Octagon Earthworks is a geometric and astronomic achievement, says Bradley Lepper, an archaeological at the Ohio Historical Society. But it's not a grand it's not as grand to Western sensibilities. It doesn't shoot out into the sky like a temple. It's splayed out over a vast area, and for that reason, there's a bias that it's just a lump of earth. Access to the Octagon Earthworks is also more limited than the celebrated ruins of Latin America. The private mound builders, a country club which opened in 1911 and leases the site, built a golf course on it. The Ohio Historical Society acquired the site in 1933 and continued to lease it to the club. This has angered many, including some American Indians, who believe the ground is sacred. Richard Shields, associate professor of history at Newark campus of Ohio State University, wants more people to know about the Octagon's significance. He leads a coalition that is organizing Saturday's all-day Octagon moonrise event. The difference between the moonrise on Saturday and the one on September 14, 2006 will not be noticeable to the unaided naked eye observer. From October 2005 to 2006, he explained, the moon's monthly extreme rise and set points are very close to the maximum extreme in the 18.6-year cycle. Shield says there are several times during that 12-month period when the moon's northern rise will take place on a clear night when the moon is nearly full. On October 22nd, this is one of those dates, and it falls on a Saturday, allowing more people to attend a nighttime viewing. Mary Happy, who is of American Indian ancestry, will be there. She's a former education specialist for the Ohio Historical Society in New York. She believes that this place where people went for vision for all kinds of ceremony to purify the soul. And another piece, bison hunt aggravates opponents. Last week, in an attempt to thin the ranks of bison outside Yellowstone National Park and to curb the threat of a disease, Montana wildlife officials chose 50 people to hunt animals near the north and west entrances of the park. More than 6,000 people, including the governor, applied for the licenses, some of which were distributed through a lottery. It is the first planned bison hunt in Montana since 1990. That one ended in ended after it turned into a public relations debacle. The state is trying to make the hunt more acceptable by leveling the field of somewhat between the hunters and their 2,000-pound targets, which are used to humans and do not know to flee. But critics on say the measures are not enough, and at least one group says its members plan to film the bison hunt to publicize what they consider a glorified massacre. The bison should not be considered a nemesis, said Mike Mees, a founder of the group called Buffalo Field Campaign. They should be considered an asset. People who would come around from around the world to see them, said Mees, who added that he is a hunter and is not opposed to other kinds of hunting. Nancy Perry, Vice President of the Government Affairs of Humane Society of the United States, said the bison hunt affords trophy hunters the opportunity to shoot what they are effectively effectively parked cars. In a state where hunting animals to fill a freezer is a way of life, a bison is a prize like no other. It weighs a ton or more and offers hundreds of pounds of meat that is low in fat, sweeter than beef, and considered a delicacy. Just 23 bison survived in Yellowstone at the turn of the 20th century. All the wild buffalo that remained in the United States after the vast herds of bison that roamed the West in the 19th century were slaughtered. Park officials created the Buffalo Ranch and brought the wild bison back from the edge of extinction. There are now nearly 5,000 bison in Yellowstone, and every winter many leave the park in search of less snow and more grass. Bison have been harvested for meat in Montana for over 12,000 years, said Governor Brian Switzer, who was not chosen in the lottery for hunting licenses. The essence of the problem is that there are a limited amount of animals that you can raise on a finite amount of pasture. Other states, including Montana's southern neighbor, Wyoming, have buffalo hunts. Wyoming holds an annual hunt for park bison, but the bison population here is far larger and more obvious, which has focused more attention on hunts in Montana. Officials say the bisons are being targeted because they carry disease, brucellosis, that causes cattle to abort their young. Cooked bison meat is safe to eat. The authorities regularly try to drive the animals back into the park, swooping over them with helicopters and herding them with all-terrain vehicles and horses. They also have trapped hundreds of stray bison since 1990 and shipped them off to slaughter, with the meat going to the Indian tribes. The Federal Department of Agriculture has told the state that if bison are allowed to wander, Montana cattle could lose their disease-free status. That would keep raisers from shipping cattle without expensive testing. There is no solid evidence that wild bison pass the disease to cattle when the two species are not confined together. And even the governor acknowledges that the state's bison policy is skewed in that of only 500 cattle live where they might be at risk. Bison advocates say that the animals should be allowed to form herds outside the park and that true motivation for controlling the pollution is to eliminate the competition with cattle and forage on public land. The last hunt started in 1985 and lasted until 1990, when the state cut it off amid criticism from animal rights activists, the general public, and hunters who thought the shooting of bison gave their sport a black eye. This time, state officials say that things will be different. All hunters are required to take a fair chase orientation class, at which state officials will encourage them to make the hunt more challenging. For example, they will be told to walk a certain distance from the road to look for their targets rather than simply jumping out of a car and shooting. It is already illegal to shoot an animal from a road. They will also be told where to shoot a bison and to quicken the kill, in the heart or 4 inches behind the ear. But those suggestions are only advisory, and people are free to hunt in any lawful way they want. The problem, at least this year, is that the bison from Yellowstone do not run from people and have mostly, like, never seen a hunter. Amy McNamara, a spokeswoman from the Greater Yellowstone Coalition, an environmental group based in Bozeman, Montana, says it supports a hunt if it is truly fair. The coalition would like to see the animals allowed outside the park, she said, but the solution has been difficult because of the disease threat. It's one of the most intractable wildlife issues in the United States, McNamara said. And I'm going to pass it over to JJ, who's going to give us another news brief.
Thanks, Erkar. This next one comes to us from Minneapolis and an Associated Press story. The title is Child Care Uses Immersion to Keep Ojibwe Language Alive. As a young child, Emma Fairbanks was sent to an Indian boarding school where she was hit with a ruler if she spoke Ojibwe. But 7 decades later, her daughter, Cleone Thompson, runs a child care center where young children are enrolled in an American Indian language immersion program. I never thought it would come back, Fairbanks, 79, said. I was worried they, future generations, would forget their Indian ways. Thompson said that in about 10 years, most of the elders on the reservations will be gone, and there won't be anyone left who speaks the language. Her child care center, in her Minneapolis home, Nokomis Child Care, is part of the first Indian language immersion program in the nation for urban preschoolers. About 55,000 American Indians are enrolled in tribes in Minnesota. Roughly 3,000 are fully fluent Ojibwe speakers, and about 30 are fully fluent Dakota, according to estimates by the Grotto Foundation, which has focused much of its philanthropy on language revitalization. Many American Indians can say certain words and phrases, but few can carry on a conversation, community leaders say. It is part of the legacy of the boarding schools that, for decades, American Indians were forced to attend. My parents didn't want me to speak Dakota. They were afraid for us, said Jennifer Bendixson, program director at the Alliance of Early Childhood Professionals, which was awarded the federal grant to launch the preschools this month. They would talk to each other in Dakota, but when we came in, they would stop. Universities and tribal schools have offered language and culture classes over the years, but now people are finding new ways to keep native languages alive. There is an Ojibwe immersion preschool in Leech Lake, and indigenous language symposiums are held annually. In the Upper Sioux community, a specialized class teaches Dakota to entire households. At the University of Minnesota, language students drive to Canada on weekends in the fall for an immersion experience at wild rice harvests. Research shows that that immersion programs from preschool to high school have the best results, said Margaret Boyer, executive director of the Alliance for Early Childhood Professionals. If you want to learn Spanish, you can go to South America, Boyer said. If you want to learn French, you go to France. But there's nowhere in the U.S. you can go and hear only Ojibwe or Dakota. So the best way to learn is immersion, and starting at a young age. At All Nations Child Care Center, the students practice counting numbers and saying animal names and colors in Dakota. They are also surrounded with drawings of symbols in American Indian culture, such as eagles and wolves. Similar immersion programs will be launched at Four Directions Child Development Center, Cherish the Children Learning Center, and Nokomis Child Care. The first batch of Dakota and Ojibwe speakers is expected to graduate from these programs in 3 years. Boyer hopes for a ripple effect. The students' parents must take a class to learn the same materials as their children, and people playing community bingo will hear numbers yelled out in Dakota and Ojibwe. Our project rolls a lot of things into one, Boyer said. So all around the community, when people meet each other, they can use the same words.
This time in life, 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 I decided I'm gonna strive, go for my goals, and do what I gotta do to survive. I'm tired of all these drugs and alcohol, not respecting my body, polluting my mind. This is not the kind of life that I want to live. I want to learn more about our traditional ways, the way our ancestors and elders used to live their lives, our dances, our songs, our language. My name is Twas. I am Nukwakum. My crest is a wolf. This is who I am and where I come from. It ain't easy being native and young, living with the influences that we see and we hear with our everyday life. So for now, I'm gonna set myself free. I'm gonna believe. I'm gonna be me. This time in life, 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 I decided I'm gonna strive, go for my goals and do what I gotta do to survive.
Welcome back to Native Solidarity News. We're going to go to the feature in about a minute, but just a little intro. We have an article from Indian Country Today that's from a few weeks ago, but is, of course, still relevant. The Kokopah tribe informed the Yuma Patriots, volunteer border patrols, that the Kokopah are a sovereign nation and the Yuma Patriots are not welcome on indigenous land near the border of U.S. and Mexico. When the Yuma Patriots said that they would forge ahead and disregard the tribe's instructions to stay off tribal land and patrol for undocumented migrants in June, the Kokopah released a statement regarding claims made by the Yuma Patriots. Jose Matus, a Yaqui and director of Alianza Indígena Sin Fronteras, Indigenous Alliance Without Borders, said that the Yuma Patriots are disrespecting the sovereignty of the Kokopah Nation. People like the Yuma Patriots are determined to invade and disrespect the sovereign nation of the Kokopah tribe just to push their racist agenda in the pretense of securing the border, Matus told Indian Country today. Once again, non-Indians are pushing to control Indian lands to hunt for undocumented Mexican border crossers. Matus said many local, state, and federal government officials support the Yuma Patriots, the Minutemen Project, and other private citizens taking the law into their own hands. He says, it has created a climate of hatred, xenophobia, and hysteria on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. It should also be noted that the Minutemen have begun patrols along the Canada-U.S. border. While they have announced rallies in both British Columbia and Quebec, they have been shut down in both cases by people angered by their racist and nationalistic actions. While the following feature deals specifically with the U.S.-Mexico border, there are a number of indigenous nations that have been similarly sliced in half by the colonial border, which is only a truce between two invading armies and nothing else. A few weeks ago, a group of more than 100 college students, school teachers, human rights defenders, anarchists, political activists, environmentalists, artists, community journalists, and concerned citizens came together in a two-day event called the No Border Encuentro. The Encuentro is a project put together by the San Diego Organic Collective, in order to bring organizers, youth, and community members together to share ideas, strategies, and skills on how to confront and stop the violence and racism on the border, particularly portrayed by the Minutemen vigilante group. To learn more about the No Border Encuentro or the Organic Collective, visit the following webpages: www.deletetheborder.org or www.organiccollective.org. This audio was produced by Blast Furnace Radio and was downloaded from radioforall.net. Also, for more information about the communities involved, you can visit their website, www.azatlan.net. That's AZTLAN.net. They are an Azatlan news collective. So, yeah, here comes the feature.